I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Craig Davidson joins me again. He's written a wonderful memoir, Precious Cargo, My Year of Driving the Kids on School Bus 3077. It recounts the year Mr. Davidson spent driving students to and from school. It's such a good book. It's thoughtful, moving, often funny, and awfully profound. You get to meet these students. These are what would be called special needs kids. And since it's a smaller bus and a smaller group, we get to know them well. How they're seen in the world by their peers, how they see the world, and these wonderful worlds they create for themselves. We learn, too, about the writer and how Craig, fresh off the publication of his first works, has to get a job driving a bus to make ends meet. We see a young man dejected by his work and how this year of driving a bus inspired the writing that came in recent years. I'll get Craig to tell us about this book, about these remarkable young people and himself. Craig Davidson has published four books of literary fiction, including Rust and Bone, which was adapted into a critically acclaimed film, and Cataract City, which was shortlisted for the Scotiabank Giller Prize and the Trillium Book Prize. He was last on this program when that book was published in 2013. He also writes novels under the pseudonym Nick Cutter. The website for more is at craigdavidson.net. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program in Toronto today, Craig Davidson. Mr. Davidson, good morning.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Very good.
So, in looking you up, you were born in St. Catharines, is that right?
It's very difficult to get a proper read on my biography. There are several different, I don't know how it's happened, but there's several different varieties floating around. But I was born in Toronto. And my father was a banker, so we ended up moving around quite a bit, Ottawa, Calgary, and then, but I did spend sort of what I would consider my formative years, my teenage years, and somewhat beyond in St. Catharines.
And the years the year or so that you cover in Precious Cargo, that took place in Calgary?
That did take place in Calgary, yeah. Mm-hmm. I lived there first as a kid, and then after doing some schooling, I was at loose ends and not sure what the heck I wanted to do with myself, and I'd always enjoyed my time in Calgary, so found myself kind of gravitating back to the city.
And so the year that this all took place, you had already published already, is that right?
Yes, I had. Yes, I'd published two books. So I guess it was 2008, 2009, and my first book came out in, I think, 2005, 2006, followed by my second book in 2006, 2007. So yes, it was sort of the year and a half after that I found myself, driving a bus.
Yeah, and The Fighter, I guess The Fighter, that was the first book, is that correct?
Rust and Bone was the first book,
yeah.
The Fighter was my first novel, though. And that was the one that that kind of just went down the sewer and took me with it.
Yeah, it had a lot of press, if I recall. I mean, you had a boxing match, but it didn't sell well.
No. I mean, definitely my publicist was great. I mean, he was and is to this day a genius, I think, in Canadian publicity, Stephen Myers at Penguin, and he is still there to this day and doing good work. And it certainly wasn't the fault of anybody at Penguin. It was, as I sort of outlined in the book, it was entirely, it's one of those things when you write a book, Joe, very few people to blame other than the person who actually created it, which is, at least I knew fairly squarely where the finger of blame lay, but of course, because it was pointing back at me, it incurred quite a bit of guilt and remorse for having handled it the way I did.
And so at this point, just before you start driving a bus, do you think to yourself, This might not work out, this career as being a writer?
Yeah, it certainly passed through my mind many times. And then you would kind of rally and you'd think, well, why not? Then you might be met with another disappointment or setback. And I'm sure many, many careers have those elements. I know, speaking now as a 40-year-old and having seen some of my friends go through, similar straits. There's lots of my friends, maybe it's a generational thing, where work is a catch-as-catch-can, and sometimes you're employed and sometimes you're not. But I think more so with me, being a writer was more something that I identified myself as being as a person. And when you write a book and that book doesn't do well, it almost feels like the entire world is, like, rejecting you as a human being, so it carries sort of this extra emotional baggage that perhaps if I'd been, you know, working at a bookstore or it just wouldn't have been quite the dismal prospect that I was facing. Plus, you know, I'm facing it as, say, a 29, 30-year-old, which felt like, oh, wow, I've got a long life ahead of me to live with this failure.
You write beautifully and viscerally about the emotions of it. I mean, there's a lot of crying on
right.
your part, right?
Well, there's certainly a lot. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of self-recrimination. There was a lot of isolating myself. It was, you know, things just compounded. There was a lot of poverty, you know. You know, there were a lot of things that, again, just sort of started stacking on top of one another, and you didn't really recognize how bad it could be because it starts out from a level of, you know, maybe you're going to be able to get back on this horse, and then you recognize that in trying to rouse this horse, it feels like it's dead beneath you, and you're not really sure how to, you know, how to jack life back into yourself, really. And so you maybe stop hanging around with the people that could help you because you don't want to deal with their, you know, I mean, well-meaning platitudes, but, you know, buck up, champ, things will get better.
Yeah.
You don't want to make them have to be that way around you. You know, you don't want to be an object of pity or worry. And so, you know, in my case, anyways, I embarked on this real solitude-like existence, which, you know, as a writer, you can deal with certain points of solitude, and probably in some ways you actually like them. But at another point, I'm a human being and a social person, so I would rather be around people. So, it got to be wearying on me and on my psyche.
And so you see this flyer, I guess it shows up at the mailbox, and it the drivers want it, and so you decide that the hours also work out for you because you work, I guess, at the beginning of the day and then in the afternoon, and then I guess you have the middle of the day you can write, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's the training involved in driving a bus? I mean, because I don't drive, so this was what interested me.
Okay.
At the beginning,
I was wondering. You know, it's strange. You're putting a book together. You know, any book, but maybe especially as a memoir. You're like, you know, it's a year of your life. You kind of think, what are people interested in? And one thing that I've discovered in this book being out for a little while is that they're you know, sorry, I'm going to say one of the things is, do I put the training stuff in? Does that carry with it enough kind of inherent interest that people would give a damn? But it's turned out that people kind of, I think some people like that, like how do you learn a job? What are the ins and outs of a specific job, especially a job such that, you know, you can go out your front door and probably see school buses going by. So, I mean, training was very intense. I think one thing that you recognize very quickly, it's not like I joined it as a lark. I joined it because I needed the money. But there are jobs that you think, oh, well, how hard can this be? In some ways, thinking of like, well, look, I remember my old school bus driver, and I've seen school bus drivers, and they don't necessarily look like Mensa Club members, which is, you know, sort of a cruel thing to say, but you think, oh, if they can do it, I can do it.
Yeah.
But you discover the actual physical side of driving a bus can be very tricky. They're giant beasts to drive around, especially, you know, your big bus, which mm-hmm. I ended up not driving for a job, but trained in. And even what we call our pre-trip, every day you had to, like, it was about a 40-point inspection that you had to go around your bus and make sure that everything worked and that, you know, that your bus was ready to transport, you know, in many cases, 60 to 70 of the most precious items of, you know, of a given family's existence. So it was very intense training, and you know, the bus company took their job very, very seriously, as they should, and it was, you know, it was a sobering experience going through all that, but I was really happy with my training, and it carried me well throughout that year.
And you also have to learn how to deal with people, and in your case, how to deal with, I mean, it's sort of like if someone has special needs.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you help or not, because a lot of them can do some of the things to get themselves settled in and strapped in, if you will, and you would help if, I guess, they asked. Is that right?
Very much so, yeah. That was one of our kind of core training methodologies for special needs passengers, which, you know, truthfully, in training, one thing that we did not do a lot of specific training for was training with children with special needs, partially because, you know, of the entire fleet It's only a very small percentage of drivers who ultimately will drive a bus for children with special needs. You know, if there's, you know, 20 buses that go to a school, you know, maybe two of those will be buses for children with special needs. So, I won't say it was glancing, the training, but it was not, I mean, it was mainly, we were whole bus training. We were learning how to drive the big bus, and we did some training in the busette, or what is kind of colloquially called the short bus.
Yeah.
But it was about a day that we spent, or maybe even half of a day, on training for children, with special needs, which, you know, basically on a fundamental level, it's how to use the wheelchair ramp, a few other sort of special necessities that you know, are different on a small bus. But one of the things that the supervisor said is that, yes, you know, you don't want to help too much. You know what I mean? You want to make sure that you don't treat these kids as if they're, you know, complete invalids, and that they simply couldn't do anything on their own. And that's something that I think, as you get, you know, you would get to know your specific kids, you get to know their limitations and the things that they can do, and you kind of negotiate that as it goes on. And they will, you know, in my case anyways, they told you when they could do something and when they didn't need your help. They were very, very vocal about that. So, it was definitely a learning curve, but then so much of that year was.
How many kids did you drive every day?
I ended up driving on my regular route. I mean, I did substitute routes with fair frequency, but my regular route was 5 children.
And you got to know them, I mean, because it's 5 children, and it's a confined space, and, you know where they live. You get to know them quite well, quite quickly.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest shocks to me, actually, is that, my initial sense was that I'd drive a big bus, and there'd be 50 kids, and having ridden a bus when I was in high school, you could put my bus drivers in a lineup right now, and I wouldn't be able to pick them out, you know, and that's not just because time has passed. You could probably have done that 2 years after I'd left high school, and I still wouldn't be able to remember them because, you know, they did their job. They got me to school and the rest of us to school and back. But I thought that would have been perfect for me because if I'm trying to be a writer, I mean, I didn't necessarily want social contact. I didn't necessarily want to have any interactions with these kids. I wanted to kind of just do my job and have my mind free for this other thing that I was focusing on. But yes, because I ended up, simply because of geographical closeness, like the closest route to my house was going to be a route for children with special needs. And so I took it, and because, yes, it's just the 5 kids, and they were very chatty, and naturally, if I'm in a situation I'm happy with, I'm very chatty as well. So we just found ourselves telling stories to one another, just sharing, you know, sharing like friends share. And it's not only that I got along with all 5 of them, in a general sense, even though there was some friction, they all got along with each other. So it was a very convivial, fun, spirited, rowdy, crazy environment some days, and I relished that.
You found out quickly that you're all nerds.
Right, that's right. We were all 6 nerds, which, if we were in school, surrounded by the bullies and the preppies and the cool kids and everything else, well, that might have felt a little, daunting, but when you're just 6 people who have the same affinities and the same likes, and we all had the same cultural touchstones, and if I told a line from The Simpsons, everyone else would know what I was saying. You sort of had that same shared cultural grammar, and that was one of the great ways of breaking down initial barriers, is that we all discovered, hey, we do have something very much in common, which is this, great encyclopedic, in some ways, grasp of just pop culture phenomenon, which, as I said, never had profited me very much before, but it was very, it was kind of great cultural currency on that bus.
So the students that you introduce us to in this book, I mean, they're funny, they're remarkable people in their own right, and it got me thinking about how, I guess, the rest of society, if you will, reacts to people with special needs, because some of the people that you encounter along the way, I mean, they're pretty much assholes, and so and you lost your temper a couple times.
I did, and I think I'm very honest in the book, in that when I was in high school, I mentioned that we had a class for children with special needs, you know, and they were kind of in a bubble. They were in their own special class, and they didn't really, you know, necessarily come into, well, they didn't at all, in fact, come into the classes that, you know, sort of the quote-unquote regular student body or normal, it's very difficult to find the right word there, student body would sort of gather for our classes. And, you know, nobody was cruel. Actually, that's not true. So, you know, sometimes the students were cruel. You know, I mean, they would not be cruel to, you know, those children's faces, but, you know,
backs,
words
yeah.
like retard would be used, and, you know, just the general casual cruelty that you would see exhibiting in high school. And sadly, you know, one thing I learned that year is that, you know, some of that follows certain people to adulthood, that I don't know, callousness or cruelty. Some of it's overt. Some of it, as I discovered, was, I don't know. I remember, I think I tell in the book, there's one where myself and Jake, who is in a wheelchair, were in a mall, and I would just see, I would just part. You know, it could be a packed mall, but people would, they would see him coming, and they would just part. They would go as far away as they could, almost. Which I'm not sure, I still am not sure how to interpret that. I'm not sure if that was because they felt like, oh, here comes a boy who is in a wheelchair, and I'm going to give him so much room that, you know, just trying to be observant in some ways or compassionate, if that's what they're thinking, and so make sure he can just have his free way through. But of course, that to Jake feels incredibly isolating, is that he's like, you know, Moses kind of going through the Red Sea.
Yeah.
You know, and I've talked to other people since, people who are in wheelchairs, and they've said they've seen mothers pull their child out of the way of their wheelchair, but more in a much more cruel way, as like, don't touch that person. That person is different, and you don't want to catch what they've got. So, you know, there's probably people who are just simply cruel and ignoramuses, and there's other people who their way of reacting to people in wheelchairs or with special needs is just to have this over-concern that can feel very isolating towards the person who is the recipient of it.
Yeah, and however, howsoever we act, we don't think about how other people will view that. And I think
you can't know, and I'm sure I did the same thing. I would, you know, I mean, that's one thing I try and be honest with in the book, is that, you know, you can only tell in some ways how society treats children or adults, even with special needs or with handicaps, is by traveling in the same orbit with those people, and then you can kind of, you're not close enough that you're, I mean, obviously you don't have the condition, but you're close enough that you can see how society in general reacts, and then you can kind of go, oh wow, that's a lot different than I thought, and then you're left kind of pondering why. And sometimes, as I said, it's very obvious that they're just being assholes, as you said.
Yeah.
And other times it's just I think a lack of awareness and maybe trying to be kind, but in doing so they go so far the other way that they actually, you know, are hurtful. So you know, it's almost above my ability to kind of to describe, but that's why it was so important and vital to me to try and sit down and try and grapple with it from my obviously very distant perspective.
Yeah, that's something that I really thought about after reading the book. How we can do better as people, but because we're so hung up on this idea of what perfect is, and or regular, if you will.
Yes.
I think
that's true, and it's definitely one thing that I thought about a great deal, and that pursuit of perfection or of whatever success, I suppose, mm-hmm. and that can mean all sorts of things, you know, and of course you don't want to use those children or their families as some kind of objective example of here are some people who are, you know, clearly in a physical way and sometimes in an intellectual way, imperfect. You know, they were that way almost from conception, and look at how they behave and you know, enjoy life. You know, because it's not like Jake always did enjoy life, you know, or some of those other kids didn't always enjoy life too. So I think the danger I grappled with was you can't turn these kids into saints, or they can't be emblematic of some human ability to hoover up certain types of suffering and still put a smiley face on, you know.
Yeah.
But that was always, it was so difficult in some ways for me because I did draw so much inspiration. I don't know. I just, being around some of those kids, it really, you know, to say it didn't open my eyes and to say that I didn't feel a certain sense of wonder around them would be a lie, but then the way to kind of grapple with that in terms of in the book was, well, it was something that I struggled with.
And the sense that I got in the course of the book, I mean, in the course of the year, you really grew up as a person.
Yeah, I was definitely, I was arrested development. I was, 29, 30, or no, I was older than that. I was probably 31 by that point. And, I'd seen my friends grow up, and I was probably seen by them, and rightfully so. It was like, yeah, he's just got his head in the clouds, and he's, he's just pursuing this dream, potentially ill-fated, of being a writer and being a creative individual. And so I think society in some ways gives you a little bit of a pass when that's, your objective. But that didn't stop me any from feeling it any less keenly because I've been raised in such a way to be, to sort of have certain objectives and be on par with my friends in terms of development, in terms of, things like wives and kids and stuff. But I think what I needed before any of that was to just kind of grow up, right? And I think that experience did grow me up, and it was a long time coming, I guess, and certainly I was behind the curve, but that certainly helped me catch up to the curve to a degree.
And the way you are as a writer, the way you are as a father now, I mean, you can trace a lot of those, I guess, whatever qualities, the good qualities that you might have in those jobs, if you will, as a writer, as a father, to this year.
I think you're right, Joe. I think there's a great deal of I think there's a great deal, and you probably have the same in your life, is that episodes come along, opportunities, moments in time that you can either say yes or you can say no, and they change you, and some change you in a terrible way, a calamitous way, and others change you in a way that's much more nourishing for yourself and those around you, so I've certainly been the recipient of both. But this one was definitely one where you just say, I don't say God because I'm not really a believer,
yeah.
But, thank whatever forces are flowing around in the universe or just chance or providence that allowed me to come in contact with that experience with those kids, with their family, and to allow me to have it, and I'll always be grateful for it, even though I don't know where it came from. So all you can really be is grateful that it came along at a time when you desperately needed it.
Well, Jake says something quite profound in the book, that you meet people and your life gets its shape by the things that happen when you meet with the people that you meet. So I think mm-hmm. it's the people you encounter that shape your life, I suppose.
Yeah, I think, and that was one of, many, many, many gems that Jake and the other kids said. I think as I've said before, I didn't really write the book so much as just chronicle it. I think at a certain point I was realizing, oh my God, the things that I am hearing every day on this bus are sometimes heartbreaking, sometimes melancholy, sometimes hilarious, sometimes profound. And there's a certain point where you're like, they are scattering pearls before swine, and I need to be the smart swine and start snaffling these things up. And of course that, that encouraged something very different, is that here I am as a fiction writer thinking, okay, I might want to pursue this as a memoir someday. How do I talk to the parents? How do I talk to these kids? How do I be honest about my potential objectives, years down the road, as it turned out, and navigate all this in a way that is very different than something that I've ever done before. Because in fiction, of course, these characters are just simply characters. Here we're dealing with, real people and their lives.
How long after you started the job did you contact the parents and say that you were a writer, that you were thinking of writing about this?
Well, it all happened in stages, Joseph. So, like, first, I was probably, I'm going to say like a month into it.
Mm.
And so I wrote letters for all the parents and sent them home with the kids. And then I spoke to the kids themselves. and you know, showed him a copy of my book and said, you know, this is me, and this is what I, you know, I did at one point in my existence. I'm not sure if I ever will again, but maybe. And if I do, I'm not sure that I wouldn't be really interested in writing something about our experience here on the bus. And so, I mean, this novel was basically based on a magazine article that I wrote that actually came out in a Calgary magazine back in 2011. So back at that point, we got in touch with, you know, I'd kept in touch with the parents as best I could and with the kids, and, you know, they were all aware, and the fact-checking process went through them, and, you know, they were called, and so people at the bus company were called. And so this novel was just an expansion on that, but because the expansion involved more personal things than were in the article, we made sure, my editor and I, that all the parents and the kids were sent not just the book, but like the manuscript before it had even got to the point where anything was set in stone, so that if they wanted to go through it and if they found anything that they found hurtful or too raw, that they would have the opportunity to get in touch with us, and we could have worked through those kind of things.
And how are they today, the kids especially? Because they're all adults now, right?
Yeah. You know, in terms of the ones that I keep in contact with, or even, you know, we have Vincent. Vincent's on Facebook, so, and I've shared a few emails with him. So, I mean, Gavin, through his parents, is doing well, I've heard. And Jake, of course, we still stay in touch, and he is, you know, at university, still working along at being a writer, you know, is happy, you know, and is happy and is productive and is, you know, pursuing, I think a life that gives him, hope, a great deal of joy. So, I mean, I'm not in touch with all of them. Nadia and... I'm making sure I do the names that we came up
sure.
with in the book.
Yeah.
And Oliver are, we're not in contact, but we certainly, they got the book so that hopefully they, not if they didn't themselves read it, but the parents read it, and hopefully they found it respectful and kind and reflective of that year and of I think, the joy that we all had together.
Now, this book has gotten a lot of great notices. I mean, Precious Cargo... is, I guess, the first time that you've written about yourself. Is that right?
Yes. I've done a few kind of like magazine articles that probably would be considered, you know, I don't know, first person reportage or whatever. But no, this is the first book length thing that I've ever, that has been completely nonfiction. Yeah.
And how's that experience been? If you're used to, say, writing novels.
Well, as you said, I feel like the early I couldn't be any more. Grateful and thankful for the early notices. People seem to generally enjoy the book, and obviously every book carries a great deal of, I would say, pressure and concern, especially for those who have read the book. My earlier days as a writer, you realize how thin the beam is that you're on, and you could slip off at any moment. So you know, certainly it's nice. It's nice to see that. You know, that the reception is positive, and that really, hopefully, that, you know, the readers come to enjoy those kids, you know, because that they really are the stars of the book. And as I said, I was just there to catch all the wonderful things that they were saying and doing.
So you have this other career as Nick Cutter. Who writes, how would you describe those novels? Horror novels? Mystery novels?
Well, just, yeah, straightforward, kind of, even pulpy to a degree, horror.
Yeah, so you've got these two careers, I mean, does it feel like two different people and two sort of careers that you have to manage?
Well, you know, probably to a degree that there is that. I wouldn't have, you know, if you'd asked me this question maybe a year ago, I would have said, no, it's pretty much they're two separate entities, but, you know, I bring the same amount of, you know, focus and determination and, you know, whatever craft I have at my disposal to bear on either, you know, if I'm working on a Nick Cutter book or a Craig Davidson book. But, you know, I think the danger to a degree is that if you're writing, you know, quote-unquote literary fiction and you're writing, you know, kind of fast-moving horror novels, there's a different pace, I think, associated with each one of them. And with a literary novel, I think you're allowed to slow down a little bit and you're allowed to kind of investigate things maybe a little more deeply, whereas I'm not saying you just steamroll over all that with a horror novel, but there is a different pacing. So I have to be careful, I think, not to carry, to make sure the pace is specific to whatever I'm writing, you know, and so you don't necessarily want a literary novel to fly along, and at the same point, you don't want a horror novel to get really bogged down, maybe in details that don't belong. So there is a certain navigation now I've had to discover between wearing the Nick Cutter hat and wearing my own Craig Davidson hat.
And like, as a writer, do you go for, I don't know how, did you go days as one as opposed to the other, or could you do, say, an hour a day each?
I probably could if needs demanded. Usually the way I do it is I will be working on new work, say, under my own name, and then I'm editing a book as Nick Cutter. So that's a little easier. You know, that's like, you know, one book has already been written, and you're just kind of, you know, you're kind of putting maybe some finishing touches on it. But I don't think I've ever been in a situation as of yet where I'm actively writing two books at the same time, one under my own name and one under Nick Cutter. So if were that to happen, maybe my head would explode. But I'd like to hope I could navigate it somehow.
Yeah. But it is a good time for you, isn't it? I mean, after reading, you know, the valleys of your
right.
life and your career, this is not a valley, if you will.
No. I guess everyone's peaks are different. I you know, it's as I say in the end part of the book, I mean, I'm probably will never be like a mega best-selling writer, but I think, you know, having spoken to enough writers, and I know knowing enough writers and just seeing where the hands stand on the clock, that's not the fate of most of us. You know, there are only so few spots for the million-selling, you know, kind of novelists, and that's fine. You know, you can't get yourself bogged down too much in what the potentials are, because the potentials are unlimited, but you have to be able to deal with what you can control and what you can do. And what I can do is, you know, be productive and you know, be a good soldier, you know, in that case, for, you know, trying to put out good books and work with good people and let the chips fall where they may at that point. And so I've been very fortunate to work with some good people, and long may that continue.
Indeed. It's nice talking again, Craig.
Lovely to talk to you too, Joseph. Thanks for having me.
This is such a beautiful book. Congratulations on it.
Thanks so much.
The website for more, craigdavidson.net. The book is called Precious Cargo. Craig Davidson, its author, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantin.